Hello and welcome to iVow. I'm your host, Jenny Prisk, and delighted to be able to introduce to you today Christina Prejean, a woman I've had the pleasure of knowing for some time, but who has joined us today because of her fascinating career. So welcome to iVow, Christina.
Thank you, Jenny. It's good to be here.
So in 2008, you joined the Air Force. What was your catalyst for doing that?
Well, in 2001, I remember it was September 11th, I walked into my first period class here in San Diego in high school, and I saw the Twin Towers burning in flames on the television. And I just will never forget the feeling of fear and not knowing what to do. And if I had, I mean, just as a high school, I really didn't have anything in my control. And I remember thinking, I have to do something about this attack on our country. I would love to make sure that this never happens again. And so I remember talking to different teachers at my high school, and I ran into one of the ROTC, the Air Force ROTC, junior ROTC instructors, and he said, you know, I think you would be a really great Air Force officer. You can help change this so that this something, an attack on our soil, doesn't happen again. And it's a really great opportunity to be a leader in our country and make sure that 9/11 doesn't happen on our soil.
So you followed that teacher's guide. And how quickly did you find yourself in Afghanistan?
So that was in 2001. And I was still early on in my high school career. I graduated from high school, applied for ROTC through the Air Force, was accepted, thankfully. And I spent those 4 years of college from 2004 to 2008 training in Air Force ROTC. And by 2008, I commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Air Force. And 2 years after that, by October 2010, I was in Afghanistan deployed for, it originally was for 6 months, and I extended it and made it for a full year.
A full year. What drove that decision to stay longer?
I just remember feeling, wow, I am in the middle of what this is all about. I was stationed in Idaho, so it was pretty calm there. And it was a great training base for the F-15 Eagles fighter planes. But I just felt like I was more of use in Afghanistan. That was really where all of the action was. Iraq was closing down the military bases at that time. And I just wanted to really make a difference and protect our country. And I felt like I was making more of a difference in Afghanistan than in Idaho here on the home front.
So I would imagine so. You rose very quickly to the rank of captain and became a convoy mission commander. What was that role like? Because you were no doubt commanding men and women.
Yes, we actually only had two women, and I believe our squadron was about 50 plus. It was a combination of soldiers, sailors, Marines, and myself and one other Air Force person. So yes, it was majority men. And I, you know, being a convoy mission commander meant that you are constantly outside of the wire, which is what we call being outside of the base. There's the base that you're at, which ours was about a mile radius. And as a convoy mission commander in Kabul, Afghanistan, our job, there were only four of us at my base in Camp Eggers, and there was myself and three other officers. We each represented the different branches of the military. And what we did was we would rotate, but we call it DV, which means distinguished visitor. It's VIP in civilian lingo, but every VIP from the Department of Defense who would come to Kabul, we would do everything from the moment that their plane arrives. So we would meet them at the Kabul International Airport, pick them up on the flight line where their aircraft was parked, pick them up and take them wherever they needed to be, whether it be meeting with Afghan President Karzai, meeting with the U.S. Ambassador, General Petraeus at that time, going to Karga, which was Afghan version of West Point. It was kind of out in the middle of nowhere in Kabul. So literally everywhere they needed to go, we would take them. And beforehand, we would have the schedule planned on who they needed to meet with, where it would be, and then I would meet with Intel and figure out what routes would be safe to take, because obviously we also had to worry about suicide bombers and bombs that would be under carpets or mats, because that was pretty common to see in Kabul. And so I needed to make sure that I had my convoy and all of the soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen in my convoy safe. And I wanted to make sure everyone came home at the end of the day to their families.
And I'm sure you achieved that. That was a huge responsibility for, if I may say, a young woman. How were you treated as a woman in that leadership role?
By other military members?
Yes. Thank you for saving me on that one.
No, I was going to say, because by the Afghan women, I mean, they were, it was interesting. They would see me and they would know I was a woman right away, and they would just be so excited and kind of flock to me and want to talk to me and so curious.
Interesting.
And they could see that I was the leader. And so they, for them, it was just like they had never seen anything like it before. So I was able to bond with them, and I felt like kind of give them a little bit of hope as to, you know, the possibilities for women and, and hopefully for them too someday. But for other military members, you do have to establish, as a woman, especially a young woman, I think I was 23 at the time. By the by the end of my deployment, I was 24. But I was young, and you just really have to establish that you're in charge, that you're the leader, that you will not take anything, and you have to be willing to discipline your members if they choose to not listen to you. I mean, especially when you're going on convoy missions in Kabul, it's very serious. They have to listen to your command. We are all wearing like our radio voice so that we can all hear each other. And as the commander of the convoy, I'm telling them which routes to take. If there are Afghan police that try to stop our convoy, that we need to just keep moving. You can never open your windows, can never open your doors when you're on the mission. So just certain things that may come up, or if someone comes up to your vehicle while you're at a stop in traffic, how to react. And they really have to listen and obey to my orders, because at the end of the day, you know, I want to make sure that they all come home safe to their families.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a very important role. So you found you received the respect that you were in your role, that your role actually demanded. You got that respect. Did you have to deal with anything, let me put it this way, that relates to the current Me Too movement?
Well, yes, actually. I mean, there were times. I remember specifically there was one incident where we had just dropped off a DV, a VIP, at the airport. And, you know, our mission was over. We were able to kind of finally breathe and take a little rest until our next DV came. And we were driving back from the airport back to Camp Eggers, back to the base. And all of a sudden I saw in the vehicle in front of us, because for us, as the convoy mission commander, you should never be in the first vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw in the first vehicle in our convoy that someone had drawn a picture of breasts of a naked woman. And you know, immediately on the radio, I said something along the lines of, I need to know right now which of you drew this nude woman on the front of on our first vehicle. And nobody responded. And then our
not
head,
surprisingly,
our head enlisted person, who usually he was the one who answered directly to me. He said, ma'am, I don't know, but I'll find out for you. And so I said, it's important because right now we have Afghan people who are going to see this, and it does not look good for us as Americans, as military members, to have a drawing of a naked woman on our convoy. For me, it was not only about myself, but it was about relations that we had with Afghan people and with them seeing us as Americans, as American soldiers, and just as members of the military. So I said, as soon as we get back to the base, I want everyone to meet with me at headquarters in my office, and we're going to discuss this. So we all got together, and some of them, you know, said, ma'am, can I take a smoke break before? No, you can't take a smoke break. You're sitting here until all the vehicles get in. We met together, and I told them, you need to tell me who did it. And, of course, none of them came forward. So
right.
I said, well, what we're going to do is the entire team is going to go wash the vehicles. You're going to make sure that that is washed off, and you're going to wash it until I come out and approve that it's fine, whether it be 20 minutes or whether it be 2 hours. And so that was what I did, and it never happened again.
Excellent. So you really made them clearly understand you were in charge and you weren't going to suffer any nonsense.
And that it wasn't, it's not funny, and that, you know, it wasn't just about obviously the photo, but just the disrespect of women and women's bodies, especially in a country like Afghanistan.
Exactly, exactly. And that leads me into my next question, because while you were in Afghanistan, you became an advocate for sexual assault victims. Tell us about that experience.
Yes. Well, back on the home front, I had done a lot of training with our SARC, which is the Sexual Assault Response Coordinator team.
Thank you.
and so I had been trained while I was stationed in Idaho. And I realized that when we were in Afghanistan, we did not have anyone in Kabul who was SARC trained or who was in charge of or even doing SARC as their official duty. Because obviously for my official duty, it was the convoy missions, and it was not SARC by any means. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because we would have rapes and sexual assaults occur on base, and you would only hear rumors in the office, and then it was hush-hush, and then the next thing you know, oh, they sent her home, and no one could ever really talk about it. No one ever knew who had done it so that we could stay away from him, or, you know, what the results were, if she was okay, if she was safe. So I remember just feeling a little bit of fear on that end when you hear that a rape has happened and you can't really ask anything about it, or how to prevent it, or what was done. And during my second 6 months in Afghanistan, there was another sexual assault that had occurred. And this time, I had become friends with a major who was two ranks ahead of me. And she knew that I was a SARC trained back home. And she said to whoever was involved with the sexual assault, she said, well, I know Lieutenant Prejean. She's SARC trained. She can be her victim advocate. Because I was a victim advocate back in Idaho. Mm-hmm. And what a victim advocate does is you advocate for the victim of sexual assault. We like to call survivor.
Excuse my interrupting, but to whom? Who do you advocate to?
The sexual assault victim or survivor. So in this instance, it was an Army soldier. She had been sexually assaulted by a Marine who was on base. And it was one night after work when she was coming back from the fitness center. Mm-hmm. And so they assigned me to be her victim advocate. And I went with her to her OSI interviews, and OSI is like the military version of the FBI.
Oh, okay.
So to her OSI interviews, to her interviews with base police, and I was trying my best to just help. As a victim advocate, you just help to be their strength and to be their support, to be there with them,
be
so
there
that they're not alone.
Them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her, I was so proud of her for being so strong and for moving forward, but the most disappointing part of it was that at the end, after she had gone through all of these interviews, we got to the point where we contacted the perpetrator's officer in charge. And we said, we need to talk to the perpetrator, and we need to make sure, you know, that disciplinary action is taken, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, oh, I already sent him home last week. I need to make sure that he was protected. I didn't want you to have any jurisdiction over him. So I sent him home to protect him. And for us, yes. And for us, that was, it was devastating for her because she had already exposed herself in a sense. And so then there were people, of course, in the military, there's people who take sides. And I'm sure not only in the military, but people would say, oh, you know, we're on her side. Or other people would say, oh, no, she's lying and making it up. And we're taking his side. And so at this point, she was still there and she still had to complete her tour of duty. Mm-hmm. But yet he was, in a sense, protected, taken out of our jurisdiction, and there was literally nothing that could be done. There was nothing that we could do. I think he was actually stationed here in Camp Pendleton, but he was back home, safe and sound.
And so what was the outcome for her?
Nothing. Ended, and there was nothing that could be done. And so it was very frustrating, especially because she had gone through the exact protocol of what she was supposed to do, and we have numerous posters and flyers on base that say zero tolerance. You know, we will not tolerate sexual assault. We will not tolerate rape. Mm-hmm. But yet what I saw is in action. It was all lip service. Mm-hmm. There is
And it continues today.
Yes.
Yes, unfortunately. I'm going to switch around here just a little bit because you're now back stateside living in San Diego, and you graduated from the University of San Diego School of Law with concentrations in civil litigation and international law. Was this driven by your time in the military that you felt the need to become an attorney and work on these litigation opportunities?
Yes. In fact, I remember during my training, it was called a bystander intervention training. I became an instructor for the Air Force. We only had three on base, and I was one of them. And the Air Force had this new rule where everyone on base had to go through this bystander intervention training, which was great because we realized that bystanders can really intervene and stop a rape or a sexual assault from occurring. And so during this bystander training, as I was instructing troops over and over, we would have to watch this video. And I will never forget, the video was of two young women who had been raped at a university event. And they talked about how at the end of the day, the prosecutor, you know, tried to prosecute the perpetrators. But in court, it came out that because they didn't have enough hard evidence, that the perpetrators were able to get away and nothing could be done. No justice could be served for these two young women. And so I would have to see this over and over as I'm going through these bystander intervention trainings. And I remember just thinking over and over, I need to do something about this. You know, in the military, there's only so much that I can do. And even as an officer, there's really only so much you could do. I mean, as a general, you have a ton of ability to create change. But as a captain, or lieutenant, not as much. And so I remember thinking, wow, there's so much power and being an attorney and advocating for your clients and just fighting for justice for them. And so I had that in the back of my head, and I said, you know, that's a dream that I would love to do. And it had also been a dream since I was 8 years old when my parents divorced. I was introduced to the legal world right away, and I remember just seeing how attorneys have so much power to do good and to really create change and to be the voice for so many people who really don't have a voice in the courtroom, and so to advocate for them. So my point is, make a long story short, after leaving the military, I took about a year off, and I traveled the world, and then I went straight into taking the LSAT and went to the University of San Diego School of Law. And I just followed my dream. And now what I do on pro bono side is I get to advocate. There's a really great organization, national organization called Protect Our Defenders. Mm-hmm. And my husband and I, he's an attorney as well. And we advocate for and we represent as attorneys women who are victims of military sexual assault. Mm. Right now we have a client who is at one of the military academies who was sexually assaulted. And they were trying to disenroll her after she was assaulted. But it's extremely rewarding. We recently met with the 3-star general who is in charge of this military academy, and I remember feeling just so empowered. You know, just as a captain or as a lieutenant, I there would be no way that I could really have an effect on this 3-star general. But as a civilian and as an attorney, I just had so much more of an ability to let this 3-star general know that, you know, we are going to be holding him accountable and he needs to go through the correct process and that he should not disenroll our client for various reasons. She, you know, as a victim of rape and sexual assault. So it's just rewarding to be living out my dream right now.
Oh, that's wonderful. You certainly are an action and goal-oriented woman. And I also want to add that you are the current president of the San Diego chapter of the National Women's Political Caucus. You're a fellow of Emerge California. You dabbled in politics in the 49th Congressional District for a while. Are there more politics in your future?
I hope so. I believe so. I think that one of the best ways as women for us to create change and to see more advancements for women all over in every different career field and just in society in general, the best and maybe even only way is for us to be leaders. And so I definitely think that we need more women in politics who can affect that change, and I would love to do that someday.
Well, we're certainly going to watch your career, Christina Prejean, and we're going to see all the other great results that you achieve, no doubt, in your lifetime. Thank you so much for joining us today on iVal.
Thank you, Jenny.